On March 30th, 1863, in his proclamation number 97, Abraham Lincoln appointed a day of national humiliation, fasting, and prayer. He said this, quote, "We have been the recipients of the choicest bounties of heaven. We have been preserved these many years in peace and prosperity. We have grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no other nation has ever grown. But we have forgotten God." Could you imagine what he would say today? "We have forgotten the gracious hand which preserved us in peace and multiplied and enriched and strengthened us, and we have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our hearts that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own." Could you imagine a president saying this today? "Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too self-sufficient to feel the necessity of redeeming and preserving grace, too proud to say that God has made us." Unquote. In Isaiah chapter 56, our last chapter a couple of weeks ago, we saw blessings and rebukes. And I said in that chapter, I quoted Matthew Henry, because this comes from the prior chapter of chapter 55, where God had demonstrated mercy to these people. He had been given his grace to them, right? Been gracious to them, like he's been to our country. He's given us these bountiful provisions. Matthew Henry said, when God is coming toward us in a way of mercy, we must go forth to meet him in a way of duty. Abraham Lincoln said, God has come at us with mercy. I'm putting his proclamation and paraphrasing into one sentence. God has given us merciful provisions, yet we've forgotten him. We've not done our duty. We have disobeyed. Today, we are going to see that the people of Judah have sinned. And God, through the prophet, is going to rebuke Judah's sin. Rebuking Judah's sin. That's what we want to look at. We're only going to look at the first half of the chapter today. Just a couple of points. You might say the first point doesn't add up to what the sermon title. But you got to wait until you reread the verses and it will make sense. Number one today, let's look at the righteous die with great blessing. You say, well, what does that have to do with the rebuke that you just said, that you were going to describe what Judah was doing and what God is rebuking here? Well, let's look at verse chapter 57, 1 and 2. The righteous perish, and no man layeth it to heart. Merciful men are taken away. None consider that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. He shall enter into peace. They shall rest in their beds, each one walking in his uprightness. The last chapter we talked about the leaders. If you look back at verse 9, the leaders of Judah were asleep at the wheel. They weren't watching over their people. And in fact, Isaiah said that there is coming a situation where someone, the beasts, are going to devour you because you're not watching over your people. You are trusting others and not God. Look at verse 9 of 56. All ye beasts of the field come to devour. That's a picture probably of the judgment that was about to come to the nation. All you beasts in the forest and the watchmen. Remember, the watchmen were supposed to be watching in their watchtowers. But the watchmen, who's supposed to have binoculars to see the approaching beasts of the field, the enemy that's coming, what are they?
Blind.
Not only that, they're ignorant. This is the leaders of the nation. They are all dumb dogs. They cannot bark. They're sleeping. They're lying down. They're loving to slumber. In other words, the watchmen aren't watching. Not only are they blind, they're just don't care. Not only that, verse number 11. Yea, they are greedy dogs. which can never have enough. They are shepherds that cannot understand. They all look to their own way, everyone for his own gain. In other words, they are like greedy people, these shepherds, these leaders of Judah, these priests, the king, the judges. All of these people are just doing whatever they feel like doing. Come, you say, verse 12, I will fetch wine and we will fill ourselves with strong drink. Tomorrow will be as this day and much more abundant. And I said last time, it was eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we'll die. And then opens chapter 57, and there's an interlude because he's going to describe the nation of Judah's sinful habits. But before he does, he says in verse 1 and 2 that he makes note that the righteous, the few that believe in God, that still trust in God, are going to, what's going to happen to them? They are going to perish. In other words, the first sin, can I say it this way? The first issue that I want to talk about today is that the people of God, the people of Judah, who were supposed to be following God, have become insensitive to the righteous. In fact, as you notice in verse 1, they don't even notice that the righteous have passed away. It's gotten that bad. The righteous perish, and look at the second phrase, no man layeth it to heart. In other words, nobody, they're so busy partying. They're so busy blind to what's going on, they don't even notice when the few righteous people that are left die. Things have gotten that bad. And so while the blind watchmen and the indifferent and faithful shepherds give themselves to dreaming and drinking, while that's going on, the righteous perish. Who are the righteous? The righteous are those who follow God. Those who are true to his word. Those who are faithful to his covenant. And the time that they are standing in, when they stood in these days, was in great contrast to the leaders of Israel. And I'm going to tell you, they are hated for it. And so while the unrighteous leaders live up their life, the righteous die. The word for perish, the righteous perish, that is a word that can either refer to a violent or natural death. But commentators believe that the death of the righteous was untimely. It was because they stood for righteousness. And when it says that the people didn't realize, or that the death of the righteous went unnoticed, it wasn't that the unrighteous didn't know that they were killing the righteous people. It was that the land had become so unrighteous that the little bit of righteousness that was left, when it disappeared, it was so bad already that it went unnoticed. It was as if it didn't make any difference. No one cared that the righteous died. No one cared that the righteous died. But not only do the unrighteous not realize that good people are dying around them, they do not stop to consider the cause of the deaths. Look at this verse. Merciful men are taken, but none consider that the righteous, here it is, are taken from the evil to come. You know what? There is an advantage that the righteous die, because they don't have to see the judgment that the Lord is about ready to befall upon his people. In other words, in this sense, the righteous that were killed prematurely, untimely deaths, probably in violent ways, are actually blessed, because they don't have to go through the Babylonian captivity and judgment on the unrighteous. And in fact, you see in verse 2, look what is the description of when the righteous die. They will enter into peace. They will enter into peace. Earlier in this book, and we will find this again, Isaiah wrote there is no peace, or something to this effect, there is no peace for the wicked. But you notice that the righteous die and they go to a place that is going to give them peace. In other words, there is a blessing for the righteous who actually, they die early. They miss out on the judgment that is coming to the unrighteous, the captivity of the Babylon, of the Babylonians, and they gain an eternal rest of peace. Notice, that's the description. They will rest in their beds. Each one walking in his uprightness. I want to read two verses to you. And I'm sorry because my notes got scratched up. Psalm 95:11. And I'm going to read a verse in Hebrews. Psalm 95:11 says, "Unto whom I swear in my wrath that they should not enter into my rest." The people that are unrighteous, that God judges, will not enter into his rest. But then if you go over to Hebrews chapter 4, we see the exact opposite, that those who are righteous, that die, that pass, that go into an eternal state of rest, of peace, of wholeness. Isn't that what the world's looking for? Peace. But they're looking in all the wrong places. Listen to Hebrews chapter 4. One of the things that I'm looking forward when I go to the book of Hebrews to preach on is to study this subject of rest, because it's mentioned many times in the book. But there remaineth, verse 9 of chapter 4, there remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God. So just taking it without even getting a great understanding of what the word rest means, it is a clear difference between the unrighteous who have no rest, who have no peace, and those who are righteous, who have peace, who gain rest from God. It's a big difference. It's obvious just in reading a casual glance of these verses. And God is saying to these righteous who perish, there is a twofold blessing. They miss out on the judgment of God on the earth, and they gain the rest in heaven with him. And what a comparison. There is no peace for the wicked. But when the righteous die, they enter into that place of peace. And this peace is the eternal rest of completeness and wholeness that man on this earth and woman so desperately yearns for. And these righteous will enter into eternal redemption of their bodies. The phrase walking in uprightness, or walking in righteousness, or there at the end of the verse, it says they are going to walk in their uprightness, is the idea of walking in a straight path. This is the reward for the righteous person. The person's reward for being righteous is eternal rest with the Creator, with Jehovah. But meanwhile, these unrighteous people don't even notice. They don't care. They don't think about their actions. Well, number two today, not only were they insensitive to the righteous, and if there's a blessing that the righteous die with because they avoid the horrible judgment of God and they enter into eternal rest and peace with their Creator when they die. Number two, the wicked are rebuked for their sinful acts. And I want to talk about a couple more sinful acts. Not only are they insensitive to the righteous, but number two, they are unfaithful through their actions of idolatry. And that's what a lot of this next few verses is about. Listen to these words today. "But draw hither, come close. I've got something to tell you," Isaiah says. You think Isaiah was the popular speaker of the day? Can you imagine being this man calling them out? Listen to what he says. "Come here, come close. I got something I want to tell you, because your actions are not pleasing to God. And here's what your actions are." He says, "You are sons of the sorceress, the seed of the adulterer, and the," can I just say, prostitute, the whore. Isaiah now contrasts these two verses, the first two verses, the godly, he contrasts the ungodly. And through this words of Isaiah, he calls the unrighteous to come to a place because he has some important things to tell them. And God doesn't mince any words. He calls the wicked sorcerers, adulterous offsprings, and prostitutes. It describes the character of the nation. You can go back to chapter 1, and we won't because we've looked at it multiple times. If you go back to chapter 1, verses 2 following, and chapter 2, 5 through 22, God had told these people, and I've said this repeatedly, God said, I set this nation apart. I set you as a holy nation apart, different than all the heathen nations. I protected you. I gave you everything you needed. There was nothing else you needed. I gave you food. I provided you with wealth. But you know what Moses said in Deuteronomy? And I want you to turn to chapter 28. Do not forget where it's come from. And what were the people doing? Trusting idols. That's what he's describing, and we'll see that in just a moment. I want you to go to Deuteronomy 28. I can't read this whole chapter. It's a lot of verses for sake of time. If you wanted to do some extra reading this week as a result of this sermon, read Deuteronomy 28 in its entirety. The first part of chapter 28 through about the first 14 or so verses are a promise. If you follow and remember me, you'll be blessed. But from 15 to 68, there's a promise, but it's a promise you'll be cursed if you forget me. So that's the difference. Obviously, sermons could be preached off of this. I don't have time to read 68 verses. But I want you to pick up verse number, hold on one second because I put it on a different page. Verse 58. If thou wilt not observe to do all the words of this law that are written in this book, that thou mayest fear this glorious and fearful name, the Lord thy God, then the Lord will make your plagues wonderful. And it doesn't mean wonderful as in wonderful like we think the wonderful buffet. Wonderful means he's going to make them... They're going to be great, but they're not going to be great in a good way. And the plagues of your seed, even great plagues of long continuance and sore sicknesses and a long continuance, he will bring upon you diseases of Egypt that you were afraid of. Every sickness, verse 61, every plague, which is not written in the book of law, the Lord will bring unto you until you are destroyed. And you shall be left few in number. Whereas you were as the stars of a heaven for multitude, because you would not obey the voice of the Lord your God. And it'll come to pass that as the Lord rejoiced over you to do you good and to multiply you, I've given you all these things. Isaiah chapter 2 says this. The Lord will rejoice over you to destroy you and to bring you to nothing, and you will be plucked off the land whither you go to possess it. Is that what happened? Where they plucked off their land and very few people were left? That's what happened. The Lord will scatter you among all the people. Did he do that? From one end of the earth even to the other, you will not serve, and there shall serve other gods, which neither your fathers have known, wood and stone, and among those nations you will find no ease, no rest, no peace. So, let me get this right. God has given them all these blessings, right? He's given us all these blessings. He's blessed us and graced us and been good to us and merciful to his people. They rejected it. And they were left with no ease, no peace, no rest. When we do not follow God, the results are no peace and no rest. We all have the choice every day to do this. Neither, and obviously this was over a period of time, of rebellion, of years. This wasn't one decision. It was one on top of another. Neither will you take your soul, neither will the sole of your foot have rest. There's got to be a sermon way about this whole idea of rest right here. But the Lord will give you a trembling heart, failing of eyes, sorrow of mind. Your life will hang in doubt before you. And you will fear day and night, and you will have no assurance of your life. In the morning you will say, would God it were even. And at night you would say, would God it was morning. For the fear of your heart wherewith you will fear, and for the sight of your eyes which you will not see. And the Lord will bring into Egypt again with ships by the way whereof I spoke unto you. Thou shalt see it no more again. And there you will be sold unto your enemies as slaves, and no man will buy you. And there's more that can be said and read in there. And take the time this week if you'd like to follow up and do that. Back to this, chapter 57. The indictment for these people is now laid bare. Come here, you sorcerers. Come here, you who have trusted idols. Look at verse number 4. Because the people were no better than their leaders. I think this is a description of idol worship. Against whom do you sport yourselves? I'll explain that in just a moment. Against whom do you open and have a wide mouth and draw out your tongue? Are you not children of transgression, a seed of falsehood? Isaiah asked two rhetorical questions. Because the wicked were continually mocking any righteous people that were in their way. And that sounds familiar to our day. Anybody that's going to stand righteously in the way of the wicked is going to be mocked. And the descriptions of sporting and opening your mouth and drawing out your tongue are symbols of mockery and derision. The idea of sporting, you can look this up. It's an old English word. I got that. It is, the idea here is making light of someone at their expense. In other words, these unrighteous, wicked people were, I think, making light or mocking, making light of those who wanted to live righteously. But not only that, they opened their mouths and they stuck their tongues. Maybe not literally, but the picture is they stuck their tongues and they wagged their tongues at those who were living righteously, a sign of derision. We're going to do what we want to do, and you can say whatever you want to say, but we're going to get rid of you, and we're going to kill you, and we're going to keep living how we want to live. And God says, you know what you are? You are children of transgression. You are seed who are born out as liars. Who were they mocking, by the way? Who were they mocking? Well, I think they were mocking Isaiah. I think they were mocking the righteous. But who were they really mocking? They were mocking Jehovah. And I know the verse doesn't say that. But I think you can read between the lines, and I think it's okay, because I think that's the point. The point is, they were rejecting Jehovah, and the true worship that they should have been doing resulted in apostasy, and as we're about to see, excessive and more wickedness. Look at the next verse. Because God's point is going to be driven home that these people were rebels against him. These people were mocking the righteous, all the while involving themselves in these shameful actions. They were hypocrites to the core. Look at verse 5. They inflamed themselves, and here's where I get the idea that this is about idols. That's the main thing going here. They inflamed themselves with idols under every green tree. But not only that, are you sitting down? They slayed their children in the valleys under the cleft of the rocks. Isaiah now graphically portrays this particular type of idolatry, and it involved every heinous act under the sun. First, as you see, the people inflamed themselves, a picture of strong lust and passionate sexual perversion. That's what they were doing. We'll just leave it at that. It was done underneath the idol groves in conjunction with the worship probably of false Canaanite gods. Jeremiah calls out this nation and says, you truly have played the harlot. That was spoken to Israel. Isaiah calls out Judah and King Ahaz and other prophets, and they call Judah the same thing. These altars were built on high hills. It involved pagan idol worship. It includes sexual things that we won't speak of, and it would incur underneath the trees. And if you don't think it couldn't get any more sinful, number two in this verse, they offered their children to idols like Moloch. These children became the sacrifices that were clearly and patently condemned by Moses in Leviticus 18 and chapter 20 in the law. And kings of both Israel and Judah practiced these debased, murderous acts, 2 Kings 17 and 16 and 21. They did it in the valleys. They did it in hidden sites. They did it in difficult places to find. They did it in secret. They did it in the open. They did it everywhere. Verse 6, among the smooth stones of the stream is thy portion. They are your lot. Even to them thou hast poured a drink offering. Thou hast offered a meat offering. Should God saying this, should I receive comfort in what you're doing? The word stones is not in the Hebrew. It says, among the smooth of the stream is your portion. There is debate about what this means, the smooth of the stream, and the idea there. And I think there's a contrast to the lofty and high mountain in the next verse. But the idea probably here in this verse number 6 is the word smooth is referring to a place, like a smooth stream or a valley area where the worship of Molech and other false gods was happening. In other words, you have gone to the places of the valley where the streams, where the smooth perhaps rocks are, which smooth rocks are found where? Mm-hmm. In a stream. So that's why they put the word stones there, a place of something that's smooth. Well, also, a smooth thing could be a nice valley. We could kind of liken that. And some of this worship was done in the valley, such as Hinnom, where worship of Moloch took place. Perhaps that's what this reference is to. And God says, you're pouring out drink offerings. You're pouring out meat offerings. What were these people supposed to be doing, by the way? They were supposed to be doing offerings, right?
Yeah.
But not to these gods. You know what they had done? They were doing the very offerings they were supposed to do to Jehovah. You know what they were doing it? To Moloch. To Baal. To these false gods. And they did it and they didn't even care. You know what God said to them? God said, this is going to be your lot. In other words, you want to worship false gods? I'll let you worship false gods. You want to do this? Have at it. Now, eventually he was going to judge him. But I'm going to tell you something, and I've said this before. Sometimes the worst judgment of God is when God lets wicked do more wickedness. And do the righteous suffer when that happens? Absolutely. Do you know who suffers? You know who really suffers? All the other wicked people.
Yeah.
I mean, you just take a look at the cities of America right now, the big cities. If I don't turn on television, I don't have one, but I do look at the media, I do peruse, I see stories. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to know crime is up all over. Drugs, alcohol, perversions, stealing. Taking what's not yours.
Killing.
By the way, do righteous people suffer in that? Absolutely. But you know who's mostly suffering in all that? You know who's getting killed? I'm sure some Christians are getting killed. Don't get me wrong. But it's a whole host of unbelieving people that are getting the brunt of that. You see, People want to live however they want to live, right? They want to just have no authority. We get rid of the police. But then when they get robbed, who do they want to call? The police.
Yeah.
And I'm against police brutality. Don't get me wrong. But the reality is you have to have an authority structure. And when there's no authority structure and no laws, the wicked eat each other. They kill each other. And it's the person who has the most money and the most power. But even those people, how many leaders? I know Hitler gets to be picked on. His life ended great, didn't it? How many of these leaders who've had ultimate authority, things have ended well for them? I don't even think we could count one. Sometimes God says, okay, you want idol worship? It's your lot. It's your portion. Have your idol worship. But he goes on, and he says, as he said so often before in this book, idol worship always ends in emptiness. You try to fill the giant-sized hole in your heart with something that is empties your heart even more, if I could say it that way. Instead of trusting the Lord to be their portion, the people trusted and worshiped idols, which led to their demise and the judgment of God ultimately upon them. So the emptiness, this emptiness could not be filled. And it would not be filled by the idol worship of the day. And so these people, God says, okay, you continue to worship your idols. You continue to try to find and fill that hole of worship in your life. And in the end, God says this. He says this, will I receive any comfort in this? No. Let me tell you today that the reality is that every single person, whether it's the people of Judah or the people of Israel's day or the people of our day, all of us are going to choose to feast and find our portion on something, either man-made things or God himself. And the application becomes clear in Isaiah 57 that idols and all throughout the book lead to false attitudes. They lead to sinful actions. They lead to a strong rebuke from God. And in the end, we have to say, if we are going to be honest, idolatry is never worth it. It will not fill the hole in your heart. It'll only make things worse. God says, you go at it. Verse 7, moving from the valleys below, the streams, the smooth portions where obviously idols had been built because they were pouring out drink offerings there. So that we know that's where the idol worship. He moves to verse 7, upon a lofty and high mountain, you have set your bed. Even there, you have gone up to offer sacrifice. So moving from the valleys below, he goes to the mountains above and he directs the listener's attention. He says, well, you not just built them down here, you built them up there. Mm-hmm. These were the altars made to Baal and to Astarte. These are gods that they had found from the Canaanites and other nations. And the grim picture here is that idolatry was being practiced everywhere, in the valleys, in the hills, and every place in between. The people had made their bed in their religious practices of false worship, and their idolatrous bed was made out in the open for all to see. They did not hide the fact that they loved their gods and desired to make rest with them. But instead of choosing a bed of rest and peace with Jehovah, the people chose the couch of idolatry and immorality. Look at verse 8. And so behind the doors also and the posts, you have set up your remembrance, because you have discovered or uncovered yourself to another other than me, And you have gone up. You have enlarged your bed. You have made a covenant with them. You lovest your bed when you saw it. Well, the indictment, Isaiah, takes a step further. Idols had been set up in the valleys. They'd been set up in the mountains. Where else had they been set up according to this verse? What does this verse say? Look at it. Behind your doors also and the posts, you have set up areas or places of remembrance. Could I say this? Areas of worship. You got it. In their houses. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 6. And I know you know the passage well. It's probably the most famous passage in the book of Deuteronomy and one of the most well-known in all of the Old Testament. It's the Shema, starting in verse 4, but I'm really wanting to really see verses 6 through 9, but we'll start in verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. Is that what the people were doing? And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children. Stop. Where was that going to be? Where were they going to teach them? At their houses. Inside their doors. And shalt talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by your way, when you lie down, and when you go. Now, obviously, it wasn't just in the house, but that's the predominant place here. And thou shalt bind them a sign upon your hand, that will be as frontlets between your eyes, and you will write them upon the posts of your house and on your gate. Now go back to Isaiah. He says, behind the doors also and the posts, you have set idols to worship. I'm just paraphrasing. You have placed in remembrance. What the people should have been doing was, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. You know what they were doing? Baal. Moloch. And I don't know all the other gods. That's what was being written on their doorposts. That's what they were worshiping. So the true worship of Jehovah had been replaced by worship, not just in the valleys, not just in the mountains, but in their very own homes. God must be grieved. Friends, are we any different? Oh, I know. We don't go out to the valleys, right? We don't go to the mountains. But what about in our own homes? Anything that takes the place of loving the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, strength, and mind is an idol. Our talents, which we think we've done something great. Our money, which, wow, I've achieved because I've worked so hard. I'm retired now. I got the nest egg. What did Abraham Lincoln say? Unless you forget who it is they gave you, who it is why you have done anything, unless you forget, these people had forgotten God. And they replaced him with idols in their very own houses. He says in verse 8, you have discovered, but the word discovered means uncovered or revealed. You have uncovered thyself in your house to another instead of me. And I'm not going to try to be too graphic with this picture. What the people were supposed to do was declare every single day, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God, one Lord. That's what they were to declare every single day. And instead, and maybe they were still saying that, by the way. Some of them were probably still saying it. But that at their homes, they were worshiping false gods. They were taking God's commands, or they were supposed to take God's commands and write them upon the doorpost of their homes. They were to declare Yahweh as the true and only God of their homes. But the nation had abandoned God, and here it is the idea. They had gone to bed with every sort of false gods imaginable. Instead of a memorial to God on the doorpost, they had placed a memorial to the gods. And it was this, they had uncovered themselves in worship, which had been to God, they had uncovered themselves in prostitution and put themselves in bed with the false gods. Almost literally. Almost literally. And in fact, it wouldn't surprise me if they took some of their gods to bed. I may be stretching it a little bit too far, but that's the picture. He goes on and he says, you have gone up, you have enlarged your bed. See what I'm saying? You've made your bed larger so you can fit more of your idol worship in with you. Was it literal? I don't know. But certainly a picture of the idol worship of the day, of going to bed with the idols. And you needed a bigger bed so you could fit more of them in. You have made a covenant. You've come to an agreement with them. And you love your bed when you saw it. These were willful choices that they made their beds with the heathen gods. Instead of turning away from their abhorrence of the foreign gods and their heathen ways, the people chose to love and embrace them. I'm going to read, and I know my time is almost done, and I am almost done, but Isaiah chapter 2, let me reread this. Verses 6 through 8. You don't even have to turn there. Just listen to this. Isaiah 2, 6 through 8. Therefore thou hast forsaken thy people, the house of Jacob, because they be replenished from the east and are soothsayers like the Philistines. They please themselves with the children of strangers. Their land is full of silver and gold. Neither is there any end of their treasures. Their land is full of horses, and neither is there any end of their chariots. Their land is full of idols. They worship the work of their hands, that which their own fingers have made. God says, Judah, you have everything. You got the money, economic prosperity. And instead of worshiping me, you've worshiped every other god imaginable and taken him to bed with you. What an indictment. Notice the last phrase, thou lovest their bed. That is a very strong picture of a lustful look that the people had for their idolatry. It was like this. Not only do we take it, we love it so much that we long to come to it every single day. Friends, how often do you and I turn from following God to following our own ways? Did you know every time we follow our own ways and our own desires? Remember Proverbs 3, 5, and 6? In all thy ways acknowledge him. And the blessing is he will direct our paths. But our paths aren't very well directed when we're doing it in our own ways and our own strength. And we know that. We know that. We've been there all too often. What pathway are you on right now? Is it the pathway of following God, or is it the pathway of trusting your own way? It's easy to say you're following God, isn't it? We all say it. Oh yeah, we're trusting God. But only you know if your life is truly living it out. Well, lastly today, and we'll just get started on this a little bit. We'll pick this up next week. The third issue of the day was they were insensitive to the righteous. They hated the righteous. Maybe we could even put that. They were unfaithful in their idolatry. Number three, they followed the heathen nations, and they had a lack of trust in Jehovah. By the way, this is nothing new in the book. We've looked at all these things in the book so far. Look at verse 9. We'll just do 9 and 10. And you went us to the king with ointment, and you did increase your perfumes, and did send messengers afar off, and you did debase yourself even unto Sheol or hell. What's the picture here? Not only had the people craved false gods, they desired to flirt with the foreign nations. You remember the stories of Isaiah, right? Remember the messengers going to Egypt? Remember? We need your help. And to other nations like Assyria. Hey, Assyria, we need your help. God had said, trust me. Sometimes they did. Hezekiah did, right? We studied that earlier in the book. But let me tell you this. The idolatry of the nation led them to trust other nations instead of God. You know what the natural outworking of idolatry is in this situation? just to trust other nations. Why would you trust God when you're already worshiping the false gods of the other nations? They believed that their false gods were more powerful than Jehovah, and therefore they believed the other nations were more powerful than Jehovah. But who was the one that kept saying, I want to deliver you. I want to deliver you. I want to save you. I can do it. And don't you remember Egypt? Don't you remember the Jordan? Don't you remember Canaan? Don't you remember these times where I've done this for you? Don't you remember Hezekiah? Instead, they sent to the king some ointment. In other words, that's all the goods. They wanted to buy the false nation or that other nation's. They wanted to give them tribute and money and goods. Remember, they had a lot of it. Just help us, keep us away from that big bad Babylon or big bad Assyria or whatever was going on in the time period of that day. The nation's idolatry led them to trust these other nations. And so be careful, friends, with idolatry, because it will take you to a place of trusting not just the idol, but it'll trust other people. And you'll think they will help you. They will deliver you. Give the enemy an inch, he'll take a mile. All forms of idolatry erode trust and faith in God. All forms. Whether it's wood idols or it's things that we have in our life. And this is a major reason why God desires the believer to love him with his whole heart or with your whole heart. Because any form of idolatry erodes your trust in God. Look at the last verse today. Verse 10. You are wearied in the greatness of your way. Yet you said, thou not, yet you didn't say, there is no hope. Thou hast found the life of your hand, therefore you were not grieved. Judah was wearied following the path of trusting in their own ways. That's the first phrase. You are wearied in the greatness. And in greatness, again, does not mean great like we think of something that's great and grand and glorious. Great means the largeness of what you are doing. In other words, idolatry and the immorality and the following after these nations wasn't just some small thing that was going on. This was what they wanted. And most everybody wanted it. The leaders? Yep. The people? Yep. God says, you're wearied. You're tired. But then, you think if you're tired, you would want to change your ways, right? Like, if you get tired, most people want to go take a nap. They want to change. They want to fix the problem. That's not what happened here, though. He says, well, you're wearied in all that you're doing, but that here's what you do not say. Well, but this is what you should say. Here's what you should say, but you never said it. There's no hope in those idols. There's no trust in those nations. That's what you should have said. You should have been so wearied and tired of, and you were, he says, of going that direction. And what you should have said is, that's not the right way. It was obvious. You should be trusting God. You should say there's no hope in this way. You should say you have found the life of your hand. But they hadn't. Instead, look at the last phrase. You were not grieved. You were not grieved. God was grieved. They should have been grieved. And we should be grieved when we live in idolatry towards God. But you know what the devil likes to do as we close? You know what he likes to do? He likes to dangle more of that stuff to you, right? You get a little bit of it. You think it's kind of fun. You realize it's not filling the gap. You realize that that trust isn't right. You know that. We know that. But then you kind of keep going back to it. More and more. Until you repent. And God had called this nation to repent over and over. Until we repent, you will find no rest. You will find no peace. Edward Young says, whatever Israel could do in the service of the false gods and idols, it was ready to do. In other words, we're ready to go. Let's keep doing it. Apparently, no task or service was too great. Nothing seemed to weary Israel, or in this case, Judah, in its desire for idolatry, unquote. They refused to give up their quest for hedonism. They refused to give up their security offers for the other nation, and they refused to give up their false gods. They wallowed in their trust of themselves. They did not trust God. And even though they became tired of it, they dug themselves in deeper. And in the midst of all that they did, they renewed their self-energy and did not faint. Eventually, though, God was going to say, that's enough. And he would send the Babylonians. So often is the case, the nation unwillingly refused to submit to the truth and found their way of error exciting, and they continued to deceive themselves. And that is the same for us, friends. We find our errors exciting, and then we want to find, we go in it more. But there is no peace. Let me close with Abraham Lincoln one more time. Because in the same proclamation, he says this: "It behooves us then to humble ourselves before the offended power, that's God, to confess our national sins, and to pray for clemency and forgiveness. Now, therefore, in compliance with the request, and fully concurring in the views of the Senate, I do by this my proclamation designate and set apart this day, the 30th day of April 1863, as a day of national humiliation, fasting, and prayer. And I do hereby request that all people abstain on that day from their ordinary secular pursuits, and to unite at their places of public worship and their respective homes in keeping the day holy to the Lord and devoted to the humble discharge of the religious duties proper to this solemn occasion. All this being done in sincerity and truth, let us then rest humbly in the hope, authorized by the divine teachings, that the united cry of the nation will be heard on high and answered with blessings, no less than the pardon of our national sins and the restoration of our now divided and suffering country to its former happy condition of unity and peace. In witness whereof, I have hereto set my hand and caused the seal of the United States to be affixed." There's only one thing I really want you to hear, and that is, when things and sins happen, the call is for repentance. That's what Abraham Lincoln was calling for. Humble yourselves. And as we're about to see in the next chapter, the person that God hears is the one who has a humble and contrite heart. The person who God hears is the one who has a humble and contrite heart. And if you know that verse, if you've heard that verse, are you familiar with that verse? It's coming up in this book, in the next chapter. That's our response. If there's an area in our life of idolatry, the proper response is to respond humbly and contritely and repent. Let's close.